Hello, science enthusiasts. Welcome to the Science Podcast. This is episode 8 of season 1. I'm your host, Jason Zukowski. I'm a high school chemistry teacher, and I am the dog dad of Bunsen. But in reality, we're all Bunsen's humans. What started as a fun way to share pictures of our cute dog has turned into an enormous social media presence. Bunsen is the Twitter science dog. You can find him on Twitter at BunsenBurnerBMD. He's on Instagram, Facebook, and TikTok with BunsenBurner.BMD. He also has a merchandise shop with some really cute merchandise wear that you can check out in the description of the show. The podcast will always be free. You don't have to worry about paying for it. But if you enjoy it and you'd like to help support the show, we have a Patreon set up, BunsenBurner/Patreon. There are three different tiers you can sign up for. The lowest tier is only $5 a month. Not that much if you want to support the podcast. The highest tier has some pretty cool swag if you sign up for it. Check it out. This episode of the podcast has some really important information about blue-green algae and its effect on dogs and dog science. We also have some timely science news tied to our guest expert, who is a meteorologist. So it's going to be all about weather, which, interestingly enough, is what most people in Alberta like to talk about, the weather. So we might as well just get right to it, because there's no time like science time. The science news this week is about how wildfires have sent smoke high enough into the atmosphere to mess with our ozone layer. Now, if anybody who lives in North America, especially northwestern North America, Canada, the United States, you would have known that last summer there was an incredible amount of smoke from the wildfires that occurred in British Columbia. There currently is enormous wildfires raging in Siberia, in Russia. And from data gathered a couple years ago, they've coined a new term for these giant clouds of smoke that have risen high enough in the air to reach the upper atmosphere. They're called pyroculionimbus, or pyro-CB for short. And these clouds have got smoke 12 to 13 kilometers up in the stratosphere. So they get up really, really high. And so, like, they've tracked these with remote sensing materials, satellites, weather balloons. So like they know they're there. The interesting thing is these clouds were predicted by simulations. So they said, what would happen if there's a big forest fire? What would happen if there are a lot of smoke or a nuclear winter type thing? Or we got a whole bunch of volcanoes that erupted. What would happen? What would the clouds look like? And the simulations predicted exactly what happened with these enormous smoke clouds. Now, what do these smoke clouds do? Why are they potentially a problem? Well, for one, when they get high enough into the stratosphere, they're more dense and they push out the ozone that's there. Ozone, as you know, protects us from some of the more harmful UV rays. The second thing that smoke clouds have in them are free radicals. So normally in school, I teach about chlorine free radicals from chlorofluorocarbons, but smoke contains these hydrogen oxide molecules, which act like chlorine free radicals and rapidly destroy ozone. So there's both a good and a bad thing also about having clouds in the air. The Earth is heating because of climate change, and these clouds do reflect a little bit of energy back into outer space. However, it's not enough to be that big of an impact. It's not like when we had enormous volcanic activity that dimmed the earth and cooled the earth and caused crops to fail in human history past. These clouds weren't quite that big. So that's one of the things that's potentially good that could help mitigate climate change. I don't know if you want everything on fire. I don't think if you'd want everything on fire. I mean, that's not a great solution to climate change. To create these pyroculionimbus clouds, you need to have a whole bunch of massive forest fires in close proximity to each other. So that's why they use the data from when an enormous part of Western Canada, British Columbia, had these huge, huge fires that were burning uncontrolled. So to recap, the smoke rises, it pushes out ozone, it contains hydrogen oxide free radicals, which destroy ozone. The less ozone that we have, the more harmful UV radiation reaches the Earth. And then that creates a bunch of problems because high levels of UV radiation increase the incidences of cancer. and can also destroy plant life and animal life. So it's a good thing that we try and put these forest fires out as quickly as possible. Also, the other big problem with forest fires, if there's enough smoke, you get Facebook pages being made about it, complaining about the smoke coming from Canada. In fact, there was a Facebook page called Throw Rocks at the Smoke to Make It Go Away and Keep It in Canada. So I think some of the Americans living in the northwestern part of the United States were pretty frustrated with all of the smoke wafting down. Sorry about that. And that's the science news for this week. This week in dog science, it's somewhat of a serious topic and quite timely. There was a pretty high profile news story about a dog owner that lost three dogs this last week to blue-green algae toxicity. They died in North Carolina, and they were swimming in a lake, and within 30 minutes, a couple of the smaller dogs, they had really serious reactions to it. They started to have seizures, and the dog parents took them to the vet, and then by the time they got to the vet, their bigger dog started to have seizures, and it's so sad. All three dogs did die from the toxicity to blue-green algae. In dog science this week, we're going to take a little quick look at what toxic algae is, how to spot it, and the symptoms. Algae is something that lives in water, and most of the time algae isn't that dangerous to you, but there's a strain of algae called blue-green algae, which is really toxic. The algae is actually known as cyanobacteria, so they're photosynthetic creatures that make their own energy from the sunlight, and they release oxygen, but also a byproduct of their process is toxins. So where can this harmful algae be found? Well, anywhere that's wet, really. Fresh water, marine water, lakes, rivers, dugouts, reservoirs, even along the coast. And it's prevalent all over the United States and Canada. You have to watch out also in your ponds that you might have in your backyard, as well as pools that maybe don't have proper chemical uptake, could also have blue-green algae. Blue-green algae blooms are what cause the most danger to dogs, and they occur usually in late summer and early fall. Usually, they occur where the water's really shallow and warm, so they're more present in ponds than they are in big lakes, but you can find them all over the place. What causes cyanobacteria or blue-green algae blooms to grow to such a size that they could kill dogs? Well, it's because of the available nutrients that they feed off of, such as phosphorus and nitrogen. Cyanobacteria algae need that to grow. They're a growth factor. So you have blooms occurring in ponds and lakes and areas where runoff from cities and agriculture will go to. They don't generally occur in nature in huge amounts, they're generally linked to human activity. Phosphorus is the main nutrient that influences the growth of this type of algae. Now, if you're wondering how we can stop this from happening, that's a big issue, and that's a municipal issue or even a provincial or state issue. So a couple things that you can do personally is use phosphate-free detergents and avoid using fertilizers on your lawns, especially fertilizers that contain phosphorus. As long as we try to keep our personal phosphorus use as low as possible, we can limit our own personal impact on the growth of this type of algae. As well, people who have riverfront and shoreline property should try to keep it as natural as possible, meaning that you just have to let the things that grow there and not try to change it too much, which can increase runoff and can, especially if you are fertilizing your shoreline lawn, you can definitely spike up the phosphorus that gets into the water. Bigger impacts can be, of course, done by state and provincial levels to limit the amount of agricultural runoff that can get into our waterways. Septic systems have to make sure that they don't get into waterways, but sometimes that's unavoidable if there's a flood, and you can have sewage systems back up and get into the local waterways. Municipalities that find out there is a lot of blue-green algae can use special types of pesticides that can actually kill it as it's growing. But if it's already bloomed, which means it's grown and died and decomposing, there's really nothing that you can do except wait for it to dissipate. And that requires the municipal governments or the state or provincial governments to constantly screen the water for those toxins and let the citizens know. So what does it look like? Well, blue-green algae forms like a mat or like scum on the surface of the water. It can be brown, it can be blue, it can be red, it can be green. And a lot of people mistake it for like oil slick or a paint, like type of paint that's been spilled and floating on the water. One big problem is that toxic algae can sink. So it may not be floating on the surface and it makes a really, really bad smell. And one of the problems with that smell is that animals like it. In fact, they like it. And some vets have reported that animals like the taste of the blue-green algae slime that's left over. After exposure, if your dog had a small exposure to it, they may just have diarrhea and vomiting, so they might puke. But it progresses very seriously to drooling, weakness, seizures, and difficulty breathing. And of course, if any of these symptoms seem like something's happening to your dog, you need to take them to a vet or an emergency pet hospital immediately. Dogs are a little bit more susceptible to blue-green algae than humans because, well, we wouldn't swim usually in something that smells really bad. And up close, it can smell really pungent. Dogs don't. And they'll drink the water. Whereas humans, when we're swimming, we don't really decide to slurp up the water that we're swimming in. And there may be like hunks of dead algae that have washed ashore that has the toxin in it. And dogs will snack on that. And that's something that humans won't eat. So blue-green algae can be super toxic and deadly to humans. But it does affect pets at a much more deadly rate. Now, while blue-green algae deaths with pets are a very small percentage of overall pet deaths, we can always do our best to keep our fur family safe, right? Like, that's the first thing I would think about when I would take Bunsen to a pond. He doesn't really like to swim. He's not a swimmer. But I would make sure that the shoreline and the water look safe for him to swim in. If you see anything that looks suspicious, if you see anything that looks like blue-green algae, absolutely do not let your dog nearby it. Do not let them swim in it. Do not let them drink the water. Do not let them even scavenge along the shore. Another thing that you have to really watch for along the coast, and it's tough for us because we took Bunsen to the ocean and he loves the ocean, is the blue-green algae toxins can move their way up the food chain through bioaccumulation. So shellfish, like stuff that washes up on shore, or creepy crawly things, or that are living in the ocean near where the tide comes in, if they eat that, they can get really sick. While the toxin can move up the food chain, usually the symptoms and usually the response to a biological system isn't as bad, but you can still have animal deaths from them scavenging shellfish that the toxin has moved its way through. So that's the dog science for this week. Be vigilant when you take your pets out. Look for that weird looking color in the water. So your best bet, if you think your pet had swam in water that had blue-green algae, is immediately get them out. If you have the ability to, give them a shower with a hose, get them clean. But if they have any of those symptoms, you need to get them to the vet immediately. It is very dangerous. It's very toxic. If you don't know if something's toxic and you're not sure, if you're suspicious, just assume that it is toxic and don't let your dog near it. And maybe we can avoid some tragedies like what happened to that family, who I think every dog owner just feels for right now. And the family in North Carolina, I know, is getting the word out about blue-green algae because they don't want that to happen to any other animal and any other family. So hopefully, if you're listening to this podcast, take a second look at the water that your dog might be swimming in. That's dog science. On the podcast this week, in the Ask an Expert section, we have meteorologist Rachel Humphrey. Let's get to the interview. Today's guest on the podcast is someone who knows a thing or two about the weather. And if you are an Albertan like me, it's literally what we love to talk about all the time. She's a meteorologist and an assistant professor at St. Cloud University in Minnesota. And she teaches courses in meteorology and education. Thank you for joining us, Rachel.
Thank you so much for having me.
Everybody likes to think they know a little bit about the weather, but you have specific training in that. Can you explain to people what your background is to be a meteorologist?
Yeah, so Actually, my background is pretty interesting. I like to think so. Anyway, it's what you would call eclectic. So my background is in elementary education, sociology, and atmospheric science. Because one of the things that I like to think about is how weather affects everybody, right? So it's not just something that scientists have domain over. So it affects everybody on a social level. It affects everybody on the education level. And so, yeah, so I really like to have that kind of eclectic background going forward. In terms of what brought me to, atmospheric science, unlike a lot of my colleagues, I was not born with an anemometer in my hand. I didn't really get into the nuts and bolts of meteorology until I was in my teens. And that was because I was really scared of the math and the physics behind it. And so with a background in education, it really has allowed me to see how different people learn differently and have those multiple intelligences and different ways of getting the concepts. And so whether I'm teaching my meteorology courses or whether I'm teaching my science education courses, it's really my job, my role, my purpose, if you will, is to get people to realize that, yeah, meteorology is something that we can all relate to and discuss. And it can be intimidating at times, but there's no need to be scared from it. So, yeah.
I don't imagine at the university level, though, you have to deal with the behavioral management that some teachers do have to deal with at the elementary or middle school level, just different types of behavior.
You'd be surprised. I taught at the second and fourth grade level before I turned to atmospheric science. Okay. And that was because I said, well, if I can handle the second and fourth graders, I can handle differential equations. There are just as many different ways of learning and sharing information as there are students, right? So behavioral issues in the classroom, they may manifest themselves differently, but at the core of any kind of teaching, it's all about knowing and reading and interacting with and engaging with your audience at all times. So yeah, it's a different audience, but it's just as fun as teaching in the K-12 system too. So, and we do a lot of outreach with the K-12 system here, locally and regionally. And so that's wonderful. I enjoy that a lot.
Oh, that's such a great attitude to have. Kids are kids and adults are just big kids.
Absolutely.
So, one of the questions a lot of people will have for meteorologists is, what do people get wrong about weather? What are some myths that people think are true that you can bust within seconds because of your background?
Gosh. Well, so in atmospheric science, my background is mainly focused on tornadoes, so severe weather.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So a lot of the myths that I can bust have to deal with tornado safety. And thankfully, I think the word is starting to get out and these myths are becoming less commonplace. But for example, there are still people who believe that when a tornado or if a tornado is coming into their area, that if it's going into their neighborhood, that they have to run around and open their windows in their homes and stuff like that. And that's, I always like to tell my students, I guess it's kind of flippant, but the tornado will do a fine job of opening the windows for itself. Like, you don't have to go around doing that for it. And the reason why that's such a dangerous myth is that people who do that are, they're wasting precious seconds. It might not seem like a lot, but yeah, that those are seconds that they should be devoting to getting themselves and their loved ones into safety, right? Let's see, what are some other myths? Some other myths that are common here, actually, are things like, well, if I'm in my home or apartment or school and I don't hear the sirens go off, the severe weather sirens, that must mean that it's safe. Well, sirens are not made to be heard inside. If you hear one, that's fine. And you should, take proper precautions. But sirens are really meant for people outside, right? Doing outside activities. So ways of notifying people outside that severe weather is coming are going to be different, probably, I would think, from, and has been shown from ways of notifying people who are inside, right? So, yeah, relying on sirens to give notification when you're inside, that's a sticky myth that we need to get rid of.
Can I ask a question? So in Minnesota, if there's a tornado is coming or the conditions for a tornado are there, you guys have sirens, like sirens will go off in certain places?
So here's the funny part, and it's not really funny. I use that in quotes, which is kind of silly because it's a podcast. but the interesting thing is that each county in this state and also in other states, usually there is a network of sirens. Now, some counties don't have a siren, right? Okay. Some of them rely on local law enforcement, other notification methods. Some of them have multiple sirens. Some of them have no sirens. There's no real standardization in terms of which counties have the sirens and what kind of sirens. There's also, unfortunately, no standardization as to what the sirens mean when they are sounded, right? So some
you could get bamboozled by the siren and not understand really what it is.
Yeah, and so this ties into the myth, I guess it's the second myth, which is all sirens mean the same thing. And that's certainly not true. And it's really important for people to be aware of what they mean, which means that they're going to have to seek that information, hopefully ahead of time, so that they know how to act when and if they occur. Now, I don't know if, so here, a lot of the municipal sirens, right, are sounded by the local emergency management officials, and they will get their information from the National Weather Service. And I don't know how Environment Canada works its warning systems with your local emergency manager.
Yeah, I can tell you what Alberta does. So yeah. We do get tornadoes in Alberta. Like Alberta,
yeah, you do. Yeah.
Alberta and Saskatchewan, we get, mm-hmm. Pretty terrible tornadoes. So when a tornado conditions are imminent, we don't have sirens, but the government pushes a button and everywhere, I'm not sure if it's a button, like a great big red button, or somebody does something and an alert goes out and it takes over everything. It takes over TV, radio, and text messaging. So
okay, great.
So yep. If you're listening to the radio, whatever's happening on the radio stops and there's like, yep. A tornado is imminent for this region. Take cover. And if you're watching TV, that cuts out. And if you're on your phone, you get a text message that comes up and blocks what you're doing. So, but we don't have sirens. But that's interesting. I know that there are places that do have sirens, and we don't. At least in central Alberta, there's none. I have another question. Maybe you can answer about tornado.
Sure.
A lot of people think if there's a tornado coming, you should hide under an overpass. At least is that a myth?
Oh, that is a horrendous myth. that's a very, very dangerous myth.
Right.
And there have been some very infamous cases, especially in the late 90s, where people have literally been sucked out from underneath an overpass. That happened in Kansas. It's happened elsewhere as well. And the reason why that happens is because, an overpass can act like a wind tunnel, right? So it can enhance the effects of the wind. And if it doesn't act like that, another risk is that you can be blasted by sand and debris and anything else that the tornado is lofted. So those are really, really bad places to be in a tornado. And unfortunately here, I don't know how it is in Alberta, but I would imagine that it's probably similar. People don't just stand under the overpasses, with just their bodies. They go under there with their cars, right? And especially if they're like a hailstorm, vehicles will stop there. And that's dangerous on a couple of different levels, or a couple of different ways, because not only do you risk what we were talking about before, but you can cause huge traffic accidents, right? And then nobody's getting down the road. So yeah, that's a really, really, I'm glad that you asked that. That is In one of the courses that I teach on natural hazards, one of the in-class exercises that we do, and this is, you know, with 100 plus students in the class, we have them write out on a sheet of paper three times, "I will not park under an overpass during a tornado." And they cannot get credit for the day for that activity until we've seen that they have written that and turned that in, because it's so important, you know, that they get out of the habit of doing that. So,
all right. I knew you weren't supposed to do that, but I guarantee you, if you asked the average person in Alberta, they would probably believe to hide underneath an overpass. I think that's still a pretty prevalent myth.
I think that that's human nature, right? If we have things that are bonking us in the head, like hailstones or something like that, you know, our first instinct is to get under something that will stop that, right? It's just understanding the physics behind it can help to get people to realize, oh, that's a really, really bad idea. And it also doesn't help when you see Hollywood. I like to rag on Twister a lot. Now, I will say that I, as a teenager who didn't know any better, I loved that movie. Are you kidding me? I used to love that movie. It was great.
I love that movie too.
But, you know, some of the science, a lot of the science, let's be honest, a lot of the science in it is just really bad. interesting, it's based off of a real National Severe Storms Laboratory experiment of the 80s, right? Except it wasn't called Dorothy, it was called Toto. But it had different success and all that. But so things like standing under an overpass or a rickety bridge or belting yourself down to a pipe and letting a tornado go over you, those are all really bad ideas. So, yeah.
What are a couple things that you should do in a tornado, if a tornado comes? Like the couple things that are, you know, there's good signs to protect yourself.
Yeah. So the best thing to keep in your mind is that your number one goal, if there is a tornado coming over your area, coming to your area, is to put as many layers of stuff between yourself and the outside elements, right? So that means that if a tornado is coming into your area, the first place you want to be is inside, right? You absolutely want to be inside. And preferably, you want to be inside in an interior-most room. You don't want to be standing by a glass door or a window with your phone or your camera taking pictures, because tornadoes aren't just a lot of wind and rain, right? They loft things. And yep. So that will end your day in a very bad way if you're standing by glass and, you know, being exposed to the elements. So interior rooms, we say get yourself into a bathroom. You can jump into your tub, put something over your head that can protect your head and your body from flying debris. Sometimes we say bring a mattress into the bathtub with you or something like that. And again, having a plan in advance is probably the best thing that I can recommend, right? So that doesn't just include, well, where do I go in a tornado? That also means knowing where to get your information from early in the day before the storms even fire. So I know that the National Weather Service and Environment Canada will put out outlooks, right, for a given region over a specific period of time. And so if you happen to go to the Environment Canada website or the National Weather Service website and you see, oh, our area is under a risk of severe weather today, right? Well, that should let you know that if a watch has been issued, that means that conditions are favorable, right? The ingredients are in place for severe weather, whereas a warning means, oh, something has been spotted and immediate action needs to be taken. So again, the planning starts hours before the event even occurs, right? Know where to go, know how to reach people to alert them as well. If you know someone who doesn't happen to have a smartphone, like myself, I don't own a smartphone, but my regular old smartphone, dumb phone, whatever you want to call it, has a way of getting text notifications, right? So checking in on people who don't have access to those kinds of things, making sure that they're weather aware as well, and knowing what to look for, you know. I don't know how to tell this story, but there are always these little anecdotes of people who are faced with a tornado And they're noticing as they're watching it that it's not moving to the left and it's not moving to the right as they're looking at it, and yet it's getting bigger, right? Which would imply that it's probably coming right toward them, right? So, you know, being aware of what different things look like, you know, exposing, getting exposure to these types of events from a safe distance ahead of time, and even if that means taking a training course or something like that, will be, invaluable when the time comes to actually act if you are faced with something like that. So I always say that the more knowledge you have ahead of time, the more beneficial it is. So, yeah.
There you go. Education is key.
That's right.
Well, let's switch gears to something that's not as scary as tornadoes, even though some dogs can act like a tornado. Yeah, this is the Science Podcast, and Bunsen is the Twitter science dog. And one of the things we always ask guests is, do you have a fun dog story you can share with us?
Yeah, so I have two fun dog stories. So
go for it.
I have to give a shout out to my former dogs who are, you know, they still have my heart. They're no longer with me, sadly. But my dog Leah, I had her for many, many years, and she moved with me from New York to Colorado when I was doing grad school and then working out there. And she was my storm chasing buddy. She would just love watching storms. And my favorite story with her is that we used to live out in Colorado, and we used to have a third floor apartment that looked out. It had a balcony that looked out over some ranch land, I guess, and there were mountains in the distance and all that. And more often than not, I would know that storms were coming because Leah would always go out onto the back little balcony and climb up in one of my giant potted plants and just start sniffing the air. And she would love watching the storms come over the mountains. So she was doing something that she should not have done, right? She should have gotten in shelter. But but she was just my little barometer. She loved them. And she was just a great storm observing partner with me.
That's so awesome, because a lot of dogs, but there are some dogs that just have extreme anxiety because
I mean, think about it, right? The dogs, from what I understand, now Bunsen can absolutely correct me on this, I could be wrong, sorry Bunsen, but you know, their sense of hearing is, I think, better than ours, right? And as you know, I mean, dogs can sense fear in their owners or their human companions, I should say, sorry. And if we're tense, they're going to get tense, right? Because they want to protect us. And here, suddenly, there's this big booming thing. And, you know, you can't really see the big booming thing. So how do you keep your pack safe, you know? But yeah, so she was definitely rare in that she used to really love storms. And the other dog, pupper story that I have is, so like I said, I was never really into the weather too much. As a young kid, I used to love big snowstorms and stuff, but that was because we got off school. when I was,
we have to have truly epic snowstorms to have no school in Alberta.
Yeah, no, that's how it was in Albany, New York, too. We had a two foot snowstorm, and then that was when we got off school for 2 days. That was it.
Oh yeah, New York can get an awful lot of snow.
Yeah, yeah, yep. But
anyway, sorry, talking about the weather again.
Yeah, right. See, there you go. But yeah, no. So when I was about 15, years old, my mom and I and our two dogs, Bear and Tasha, and Tasha was this big Rottweiler mix, but at the time she wasn't that big. She was only about 6 months old, and Bear was my yellow lab. And we were camping in upstate New York. We were camping in the Adirondacks in a place that had wilderness camping, right? So there were no rangers around. There was no nothing. It was basically hike in, find a spot, plunk your stuff down, and voila, here you are camping. And we loved it. We had a great time. And one morning in July of 1995, my little puppy at the time, Tasha, started growling ferociously, just really growling and snarling. And, you know, she's a 6-month-old puppy, so what does she know about growling and snarling? But again, protecting her pack. And she was just pawing to get out of the tent. So this was at, you know, very early morning hours. And we were just, you know, we were wondering, oh, is there a bear around? It's, you know, whatever. And we opened the tent flap, the tent door, and the sky was a color that I had never seen before. It was, it was bright red. There were all these really ominous looking clouds, which today I know were Mammatus clouds, you know, the little pouches that hang down under the anvil of a thunderstorm. And I was terrified, because I'm half asleep, my dog is going crazy, you know, bear is also going crazy, bear was the lab, they're going nuts pretty much, and my mom is, you know how when someone is trying to pretend like not scared, you can kind of see through it, right? But so she's putting up a brave face, but the dogs are going, you know, barking all over the place. And I was really, really, really scared by that. And what happened was that event was known as it was a derecho event, which is basically a big bow echo of thunderstorms that travel at a very high rate of speed over a given area. And that was a gigantic blowdown, right? So it was a big windstorm. And so what happened was in the area where we were camping, there were all sorts of trees that were blown down. Unfortunately, about 2 miles away from us, people were crushed in their tents, and they didn't make it, and things like that. And what scared me the most about all of that was that we had no warning. Right. Because this was before cell phones. This was before we had a weather radio. We had a regular radio, but it wasn't on because it was, you know, very early in the morning. And I was really kind of, if I'm going to, you know, be honest about it, I was traumatized by that event. And it was a few weeks later, after I stopped being traumatized by it, that I started wondering why. Right. Why did that happen? How did that happen? And so I always say that that's one of my favorite dog stories, because it was my dogs who alerted us, you know, and we were able to take as many precautions as we could. Now, our tent got rolled with all of us in it. So clearly there was, you know, it was a very, very strong wind event. But
was that wind like a plow wind, like where it was just like a giant, huge push in a small amount of time? Or was it a
No. Yeah, that's what it was. So,
Okay. Yeah. We had one of those in Alberta, central Alberta, 2 years ago, and it caused like absolute chaos everywhere. It was super dangerous.
Yeah. And so it's a little bit different from a microburst, right? So microbursts are very small localized events. And derechos can be hundreds of miles long, right? As a matter of fact, that's one of the things that is a requirement for them to be designated as such. But yeah, it was all straight line wind damage. And so it was a giant blowdown. And so I was very thankful to my pup for many years after that. Those are my two dog stories.
There we go. Bunsen's got to step up his A game and alert us about extreme weather.
I've seen pictures of his gear, you know, his ferocious battle gear there. So
his battle gear,
so, you know, he'll be protected from anything that falls. So no hail injuries for him.
I would be remiss if I didn't ask you about, and I know you're not a climate scientist, but you do have training with weather, and weather and climate get mistaken all the time by people who don't know their definitions. I was wondering what you think about climate change.
Yeah. So I think, and like you said, and thank you for acknowledging that I am not a climatologist, right? So I deal on a very different time scale climatologists. But I think that, so I am at my core, I'm a scientist. And so I rely very heavily on data as opposed to opinions and politics and all that fun stuff. The data that has come from not just our, you know, our governments, yours and mine, but from all over the world, right? You've got a lot of scientists who've collected a lot of data who have said, hey, climate is changing. And the thing is, a lot of people like to say climate change is just global warming. And then when there are examples of an area being cooler than normal, they automatically say, see, global warming isn't happening because that place is colder, right? Well,
yeah, I know that makes me grumpy.
I know it does. Absolutely. you're like, oh, science. But no, but when we talk about climate change, it's important to not just focus on temperature, right? Because climate is an aggregate of not just temperature, but wind flow patterns and precipitation distributions and, you know, land-sea distributions as well. And so I think that if we rely on the data, which has been coming in, and it's been coming in for a long time, if you speak to scientists in the communities of meteorology and climatology, there's a very, very strong consensus that things are changing. Right now, there's a little bit less of a consensus, there's a little bit less of a certainty that humans are solely responsible, right, for these changes. I don't think that there are too many people who would say, you know, humans are the only cause, right? We realize that we are a part of a large system. But we also know, because we know things from physics and we know things from chemistry and math and atmospheric and oceanic sciences, we know that we can influence it. And we also know, again, relying on the data, we know that we have had a pretty big impact on it since certainly the last 50 years. Some people would say the last 150 years, but we've really seen a noticeable increase in changes in the last 50 years. It's not a matter of not having data. We have the data. The data is there. You know, no one is out there falsifying data. So my feelings on climate change or climate in general is that I don't think that there's harm in reducing the stuff that we put out of our car exhausts or our factory smokestacks, right? We know that when we put excess greenhouse gases, carbon dioxide, methane, etc., into our atmosphere, we understand how the physics work, right? They are selective absorbers, so they allow sunlight in, they allow shortwave energy from the sun in, but they trap a lot of the outgoing longwave radiation. And so we know how that stuff works, right? And so I think it's very important for all of us to take the necessary steps to curtail what we put up there. Now, there are some people who say, oh, we've only got 12 years left. Well, no, we don't just have 12 years left, right? But what we have to realize is that what we do currently, as well as in the short term, can have long-term effects, right? And it's not just for us, right? It's for everywhere around the world. And so climate is everywhere. It's not isolated to a certain, you know, spot on a map. And I think we need to kind of remember that.
You betcha. I like that. That's what I tell my students, is that climate affects all of us, and it's everywhere. It's not just in our little corner of the world.
Yeah.
And we'll see changes within 100 years. Yeah. That other people will see, you know, devastating changes. It's going to be different, and it's going to be, you know, there's going to be a spectrum of things that are affected.
Yeah.
I thank you for your opinion on it. So, and I appreciate that.
Yeah. No, thank you for asking.
One of the things we always ask our guests on the podcast is the super fact. I love this section because I learned so much.
Yeah.
I learned so much from our expert guests. And the super fact is something that, you know, that you, when you tell people, it just like, like it just blows their mind up. It's something that they never would have thought before about your area of expertise. So can you share with us your super fact?
Yeah. And I always share this fact with my students too. And they, you know, and they're just the jaws drop, you know, when I say it. So if you've never seen a lightning strike before, right, I can describe it. There is a bright flash. There is a clap of thunder sometimes, depending on how far away from the strike you are. And it's usually over pretty quickly. The individual flash, right? Happens very, very quickly.
Yeah.
But a lot of times you don't think about what the longest strike was in terms of the length of it. Literally, not the length of time that it existed, but the amount of distance that it covers, right? So the longest lightning strike that has been verified by the World Meteorological Organization. So it's not just one station saying, hey, we have the world record. This is now the World Meteorological Organization saying this. The longest strike on record stretched over 320 kilometers in length. So that's 200 miles.
Did it arc across, like, because that's not up high, is it? Like, did that?
That's not up high. Like, no, that's not.
It arced along the curvature of the Earth then, or?
Yeah, yeah. Oh, my goodness. So this was in Oklahoma in 2007. And it took until 2016 for it to be verified. But it was verified, absolutely. And so that is ridiculously long. And that's I bring that up because when we're talking about storm safety in my classroom, you know, what I show them is, you know, if you've ever heard the term bolt from the blue, where it seems like a lightning strike comes out of nowhere, right? Usually we talk about that about 30 miles away from, you know, from the storm or something like that. But this bolt was 200 miles away, right? So, 321 kilometers or so. And yeah, so that's my little factoid there. The longest, I had to look this up because I was like, well, that's talking about distance. The longest lasting strike was almost 8 seconds long.
Like a continued,
a continued strike. Wow. And if you think about that, right, if you count out 8 seconds in your head, it was like 7 3/4 seconds in your head. That is a really, really long time for a strike to occur. And it wasn't that strike. That was a totally separate strike over in France. So yeah, there are a lot of really interesting facts out there, not just related to, you know, tornadoes, but there are some lightning facts for you. So
can you imagine your brain would break if you saw a lightning strike that just never went away? You'd be like, what, what exactly is happening? This isn't real.
Yeah.
Has the world paused? Or if you were that unlucky person that got blasted by that lightning strike from 200 miles away. What a rough day.
Exactly. So, I mean, going back to the safety and knowledge and education side of things, in my classes and certainly in the National Weather Service trainings and things like that, they will often tell people that if you are close enough to, if you are able to count to 30, if you're not able to count up to 30 when you hear when you see a lightning strike, if you can't get to 30 before hearing the thunder after seeing a lightning strike, there we go. then you are close enough to be struck. Right now, obviously, that 200 mile lightning strike was very, very rare, but people do and can and have gotten struck by lightning, even when the storm is, you know, very far away from them. So the 30-30 rule that was established by the Weather Service is, you know, if you can't count to 30 seconds before hearing the thunder after seeing a lightning strike, you're close enough to get struck. And they also recommend waiting 30 minutes after hearing the last thunder before venturing back outside. So yeah, I don't know. The Weather Service has a bunch of really cool sayings. So that's like their 30-30 rule. And they have, if the thunder roars, go indoors and all that fun stuff. So yeah.
We're at the end of the time and I've kept you for a little bit longer, but it's been a fascinating discussion. Can people find you on social media?
Yeah, they can. So I am not on Facebook, but I do tweet. They can find me at Go Ask a Scientist.
I love that handle. I love it.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
And is there any organization that you'd like to bring people's awareness to or anything like that before we close?
Oh, gosh. Well, sure. So I would definitely recommend checking out your local chapter of Environment Canada or National Weather Service. Got to get those plugs in there.
No, yeah.
Also, your local library. I have an affinity for libraries. I know that we tend to go to the computers and stuff like that, but check out your local library as well. So there's lots of information there, not just on weather, but on lots of other types of science as well. So get thee to a library, as they say.
That's great advice. Well, you know what? Thank you so much for agreeing to be on the Science Podcast. And hopefully people who have listened, they're going to learn a little bit more about weather, tornadoes, and lightning strikes. I guess don't hide underneath an overpass. That's the message of the day.
See, there you go. You would have gotten credit in my class for that.
A++.
That's right.
Okay, take care. Have a great day.
You too. Bye.
It's time for Woo or Wow Weather Edition. Oh boy, you're going to be given three statements. Two of the statements are not going to be true. They're going to be woo. One of the statements is going to be wow. It is going to be true. Are you ready? Statement one. Raindrops are shaped like teardrops. Statement number two. Seattle is the rainiest United States city. And statement number three. Calgary, Alberta, Canada has more sunshine than Florida. Okay, think about it. Time's up. All right, let's look at the second statement. Seattle is the rainiest United States city. Not true. That's woo. Seattle doesn't have the most precipitation. That's not true. That's woo. New York and Miami actually have more precipitation than Seattle does. That being said, Seattle has more days with precipitation, which might give it the appearance of being very wet. It doesn't rain as much, but it rains more frequently. Also, it appears that Seattle seems to be more cloudy than other U.S. cities too. But Seattle is not the rainiest United States city. All right, that leaves two left. One is woo, one is true, and the one that is woo is the raindrop shape. So that one is not true. Raindrops are not always tear-shaped. Some can be. As they get bigger, really small raindrops are actually spherically shaped, so circular. As they grow and as they fall to the earth, they might flatten out a bit. And once it becomes really, really big, a raindrop actually busts apart into two separate drops. And those two separate drops are the most tear-shaped that you're going to get. As the raindrop gets bigger, it kind of starts to look like an amoeba or like a cell that's dividing. So you don't get that tear shape until they actually bust apart. And then they look to your shape, but then as they fall, they'll actually become spherical again. So that's not true. That leaves the true statement being Calgary getting more sunshine days than Florida. And that's absolutely true. Most people don't think of Alberta and Saskatchewan in Canada as being really sunny. You have to remember, it doesn't have to be hot for the sun to shine. Calgary, Alberta, Canada gets more sunshine hours than any place in Florida. It's really more remarkable. In fact, there are 300 sunny days, which makes central and southern Alberta and parts of Saskatchewan ideal for solar panels and solar collection. But that's a whole economic thing. Alberta has an enormous amount of natural gas, coal, and oil. So it's a hard sell getting us to switch to solar energy. And that is Woo or Wow Weather Edition. And so this is the end of this week's podcast. Thank you so much for listening this week. And thanks so much to Rachel, our meteorologist expert. Please remember to check your waterways for blue-green algae. And if you're not sure, just don't let your dogs get into the water. We can avoid some senseless tragedies now that we're more educated about it. Let's close with Bunsen's motto, for science, empathy, and cuteness.